Welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists from Pharmacy Times. I'm your host, Craig Beavers, and we're very excited to bring an outstanding episode today with a good friend and peer who I've enjoyed working with and learning from always. Before we get into that, I just want to remind people, if you like this content, like, subscribe, rate us, send us feedback. We'd love to continue to make changes for content and everything. And this episode is going to be great because it's very timely, and it's one I've been mapped out and waiting for to be a part of. And so I'm excited to have this for a variety of different perspectives. A, because the person talking is amazing and knowledgeable. B, she got to serve as a pharmacist on this set of guidelines. And C, it's a topic that is constantly evolving and important topic for awareness. So without further ado, I'm going to jump into the interview and education piece, if you will. So I'm going to start out and introduce Dr. Allison Burnett. Allison, welcome to the show. Can you introduce yourself, who you are, where you practice, and what you do?
Sure, I'd be happy to. But let me start by saying thank you, Craig, for the opportunity to be on the Telltale Heart podcast. It's an absolute pleasure. And thanks to everyone who tunes in and listens to this episode. My name is Allison Burnett. I'm a thrombosis and hemostasis pharmacist at the University of New Mexico Hospital, which is about a 600-bed academic medical center in Albuquerque. And we serve as the region's level one trauma and the comprehensive stroke center. I also serve as the residency program director for our PGY2 pharmacy residency in thrombosis and hemostasis. Craig, that's just a shameless plug. So if there's
any physicians
out there.
And just to give people perspective, there's been a lot of work and emphasis on how subspecialized this is. And that's why we have a PGY2 in this. And obviously a lot of work with the Anticoagulation Forum and doing stewardship. And, you know, we don't, this could be a complete episode, and maybe someday we'll get to that about what this is. But I mean, clearly off the foundation of antimicrobial stewardship, the complexity of dealing with this, and this is a great topic that will demonstrate this, of dealing with these patient populations and even some of the gaps that exist. And so it's a prime place for pharmacists to be engaged in. So, yeah.
Yeah. And it's just a really fun job. I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not stuck in one thing. You know, a lot of people think, you're so specialized, you're not doing, a variety of things. But, you know, my day-to-day at the hospital is, I get to work with really awesome multidisciplinary colleagues across the entire organization, you know, cardiologists, hematologists, critical care, neurostroke, emergency med. And we're managing these, you know, complex thrombosis and hemostasis cases, including PE. And so it's really fun and challenging to try to optimize those therapies and provide, you know, the best patient care that we can through antithrombosis stewardship. So I love my job. I'm very passionate about it, and I'm very fortunate to be able to do what I do.
And I will tell you, just as a side, everyone, if you haven't understood what anticoagulation or antithrombotic is, what we're actually calling it now, antithrombotic stewardship, you know, you can go to the Anticoagulation Forum website, but Allison has done lots of talks and things that you can find on the internet about this and published papers. It's, again, and maybe that's something we come back to another day and partner with, because this could be a whole separate domain of interest and so forth, but never do. To me, this is like a hot off the press episode, or almost hot off the press. The PE guidelines were released at the time of this recording about 3 or 4 days ago. So it's Monday, February 23rd. This will, you know, drop the first week of March on the Tuesday. So it's still relatively new. And this is the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association. And there, it's the first time that they've released new acute pulmonary embolism guidelines. Now, I think, you know, there maybe have been other guidelines and things in the past, and we can most certainly talk a little bit about this. But first and foremost, Allison, you had the honor of serving as the only pharmacist and actually the only cardiovascular team member on the guidelines. Can you share with me what your experience as the pharmacist on the guideline committee was like? Like, you know, kind of what was your role? For those who don't appreciate, A, how guidelines are formed and function, but how important the role of the pharmacist was. And I know you can't get in the nitty-gritty of like all the decision-making processes, but I think just hearing this perspective, that's one thing that's unique about this journey from this process. So do you mind to share that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And you're exactly right to use the word honor. It was an absolute honor to be invited to serve on these guidelines, and more so to be the, the lone pharmacist representing our profession and bringing our perspective. It was such an incredibly collaborative, multidisciplinary experience. Throughout the entire process, there was this broad acknowledgement of the value of pharmacist input in caring for PE patients, especially because of things like our expertise in pharmacology, our awareness of how to navigate the health system, and also, our prowess around transitions of care. One of my roles on the guideline was as primary author of the hemodynamic management section. Now, Greg, this was a short but definitely challenging section because the evidence base is so thin. So this required a lot of thoughtful discussion on how to balance data or lack of data with clinical judgment, and how to, use evidence that's really indirect, that mostly comes from, non-PE patients that are, in cardiogenic shock. My favorite role was as a primary reviewer for the anticoagulation section, which is pretty beefy, because anticoagulants are the cornerstone of PE and DVT treatment, and really this is my jam, this is my wheelhouse, right? And I got to work closely with some incredible experts like Dr. Lisa Moores, who you may know from her role with several of the CHEST guidelines. We also had Rachel Rosofsky and Anna Casanegra and Mary Cushman, all incredible individuals. And I learned a tremendous amount through this process, not just from those extensive literature reviews that we had to conduct to inform the guidelines, but also interacting with these individuals and understanding how different disciplines approach PE management in their real-world practices. And throughout the entire process, my input as a pharmacist was sought out, and I was able to contribute my perspective around antithrombotic stewardship, and how to translate evidence to the bedside, and also how to ensure appropriate care all along the care continuum. And so, as you've been involved in several guidelines yourself, Craig. We went through multiple rounds of refinement and discussion because we really wanted to ensure that the recommendations were both evidence-based and practical, but really importantly, clear enough for the end users to apply in their practice. So it was just a really valuable experience, and I was very proud to represent as a pharmacist.
No, that's awesome. And if you can't tell me, I totally appreciate that. And the reason for the audience, Allison has some restrictions on things she can or cannot say as part of the guideline process, but just the pharmacist doing the hemodynamic section, and I'm not saying that you can't do it. Was that something you chose, or they assigned that to you, or does that make sense, that type of question? Because you're like, to your point, I get you have to review the anticoagulation section, which is like your jam, but it just intuitively, that's not the first place I would have been like, oh, the pharmacist did the hemodynamic section. And not that we can't do it, so I don't want to discredit pharmacists. That's not what I'm saying. But is that, did you volunteer for that, or was it assigned to you, or?
Yeah, so it was actually assigned to me, but I was paired with an amazing physician, and we also, as we went through the process and we, reviewed the literature and came up with recommendations, et cetera. Then there were, big collective meetings of everybody providing their perspective and input on what had been crafted to make sure that we were on point. And so I think it was a very rigorous and hopefully fruitful process, and hopefully, it came through, our intentions came through in the end product.
Well, that's awesome. And if you haven't had a chance to look at them, I'd encourage you to. I got to have the honor of looking at them before they were published, because I got to write a editorial to the guidelines that is going to be published soon. So I'm excited to get to talk to you about them out loud and in the open. So, Allison, and maybe you can give some history to this. This is the first time this group, the ACC and AHA, has pulled together these type of guidelines and done this. And like I alluded to, there's maybe CHEST or other people that have done these guidelines, and you can maybe outline what has happened with CHEST, but why now, and why is this important? Like, what was the impetus for the ACC and AHA to be engaged in this guideline process, and why has this been so critical to have this set of guidelines?
Yeah, well, I think, let's start with why it's important. I mean, why is it important to have good PE guidelines? PE remains a major cause of morbidity and mortality around the world. I think it's the third, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's the third leading cause of cardiovascular death behind myocardial infarction and stroke. And what's even more striking is that the prevalence of VTE is anticipated to at least double and maybe even triple over the next 2 decades because of obesity and an aging population. So all of us clinicians are going to be caring for a growing number of PE and DVT patients. I think what's unfortunate is that if you look at a granular level, PE management varies widely across institutions, and this leads to suboptimal care and bad patient outcomes. And so I think ACC, AHA, and all these other entities coming together to create this cohesive document provides a contemporary multidisciplinary framework that aligns some core tenets of PE management, like accurate risk stratification, anticoagulation, and other advanced therapies, and systems-based management all in one place. So I think this is an important document. I think it's very timely. And I think you're right to acknowledge, prior guidelines like ESC, the European Society of Cardiology 2019 guidelines, as well as the CHEST antithrombotic guidelines, because they've been instrumental in shaping practice, particularly around things like stratification and anticoagulation. But I think ACC/AHA guidelines take it a step further. And why now? I think it's because, as I mentioned, ESC guidelines, those are the most recent ones. Those were from 2019. It's been 7 years now. It's hard to believe. But this field of PE management has evolved significantly over that time period. And since those ESC guidelines, we've seen a rapid growth in things like catheter-based therapies, whether it's lytics or thrombectomies. And there's, excitingly, there's now a number of ongoing clinical trials in this area that's going to better inform these practices. But we're also seeing increased use of multidisciplinary PERT teams or pulmonary embolism response teams, and more emphasis on systems level processes for care delivery. And then I think very importantly, something that's going to stand out to people is just in this guideline is a big change in risk stratification. So in sum, the landscape around PE management simply looks dramatically different than it did even a handful of years ago. And so this guideline was much needed.
Yeah, very good. And I think you alluded to a little bit of some of the difference. Obviously, the timing, it's been a while since we've had some of these guidelines. And to your point, things have evolved and changed. And pulmonary embolism response teams are getting more and more pronounced or defined. And for people that may not be aware of that, we equate that to like a STEMI response team or stroke team that you would see in these other disease states, and modeling off that, and it'd be a multidisciplinary process to manage these patients acutely and quickly and stratify them. And we'll probably talk about that here in a moment with the guidelines. So I think you've done a nice job. How are these compared or different? Clearly, we have continually to evolve, and there's lots to still be understood or discovered in the area of pulmonary embolism management from that standpoint. So very good. So this may be a dense topic that we have lots of different questions or side questions on, but being an author that's close to this, what in your mind are the big key takeaways from this guidelines? Like the things that you're like, if, and I know ACC does this for people that are interested, like what are the 10 key takeaways, but I think you being a pharmacist and your perspective of this and doing thrombosis and hemostasis, what are your kind of takeaways? And maybe as you present them, I ask you some questions about them. So.
Sure. Well, you're right. The guidelines, there's a lot to unpack in the guidelines, and I do hope that people who are tuning in will check them out. I'm going to say the biggest thing for me, and I think for a lot of people, is this new risk stratification schema. And what this does is it takes the ESC 2019 risk stratification of low, intermediate low, intermediate high, and high PE, and it basically makes it more granular, and it takes it to five categories, A through E. And the intention is really to take, those intermediate risk PEs and help us better tease out who are the patients that are going to tip towards decompensation and deterioration and derive the most benefit from an advanced therapy versus those who are, you know, might have some RV strain and some elevated cardiac biomarkers, but they're not going to decompensate. And so I think this is going to be something that institutions and clinicians are going to really need to spend some time with and understand so that they can implement them into practice. Ultimately, I think it will be very helpful. In that same vein, I think another thing that's a big takeaway from these guidelines is that, you know, most PE patients are not those that are not those in the E1 and E2 category that have cardiogenic shock, et cetera. Most of them are either low risk or in that intermediate category with the, you know, about half of them being low risk. And so what does that mean? That means that if they're a category A or B and low risk, they do, likely do not need to be admitted to the hospital. So this is a huge opportunity for stewardship and a huge opportunity for pharmacists to practice at the top of their license. And there's actually a lot of publications coming out now about pharmacist-led outpatient DVT clinics. And I will say at our institution, we actually own this. We are our stewards are in integrally involved in real-time acute VTE alerts and real-time risk stratification. And if the patients are low risk, the other members of the multidisciplinary team really just turn management of the patient over to us from soup to nuts. So we do the prescribing, we do the education, the meds to the bedside, transitions of care, et cetera. So I think that's another big takeaway is that we don't have to admit a lot of our PE patients, which has been a point of hesitation for many, many years in the United States, which is in stark contrast to outside of the United States.
Well, and I think would you agree that part of that paradigm change is obviously with the introduction, and we'll talk about this, the direct acting oral anticoagulants and people doing that. But to your point about the staging, is it because we can get a very comfortable feel based on, if you're not aware, depending on where the patient is, you're going to do some risk scoring, right? To understand based on the clinical data, you're going to use the clinical data and or risk scoring tools to really understand who are the patients that are safe to be managed. This is, the version of this. And to your point, there are a lot of patients who can be safely discharged. And I think what I'm hearing, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, is the staging and the way it's done is really designed to indicate to people, and that could be clinicians, administrators, payers, et cetera. These patients don't have to be a burden on the healthcare system from that standpoint. So is that kind of what your sense is? Is this is how we've gotten to this point because of the ability to use diagnostic criteria and scoring and have, kind of more consistent and reliable options that don't require injections? Is that what the piece of the evolution has occurred?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think it's all of those things. I think it's the advent of these newer, easier to use therapies like the direct oral anticoagulants, the risk scores that have been developed and validated, which by the way are really good at identifying, you know, patients who are at low risk and can be, you know, safely discharged, like the simplified PESI or the HESTIA. Not so good at identifying the patients that are going to decompensate, but really good at ruling out patients who are going to have an adverse event. So yeah, I think it's a culmination of all of those things. I do think we've been a little, maybe a little slow on the uptake of capitalizing on that. But I am encouraged by, you know, as I mentioned, the publications that I'm seeing coming out about, you know, pharmacist-led outpatient DVT clinics, et cetera. We actually have colleagues, doctors of nurse practitioner that have started their own ambulatory care DVT walk-in clinics. So I think we're moving in the right direction, and I'm glad to see that the guidelines are supporting that move.
Well, and I will tell you, this is consistent with all the ACC guidelines. They're very much in a team-based care fashion, so I think that that's good, or they support that whole concept.
Can I comment on just one other thing really
Sure.
quickly about a takeaway from the guidelines? Because I think this
Yeah,
is really
no, keep doing. We
important.
have lots of you. We I hear want to hear all your takeaways for sure.
Well, I think this one's just really important because it's maybe something that isn't as well recognized as it should be, but it's becoming more and more recognized. And so, you know, the guidelines, as I mentioned, the anticoagulation recommendations are pretty beefy. And one thing that stood out to me when I read, you know, the draft in totality, when I got the first chance to see it, was that there was authors of a section, and they were very cognizant to include considerations around abnormal uterine bleeding and heavy menstrual bleeding in females. And what for years we have underappreciated the impact that anticoagulation has on women who are premenopausal or menopausal and who need hormone therapies to help control bleeding or with menopausal symptoms. And so for many years, you know, if a female had what was considered to be a hormone related VTE, we would immediately, you know, instruct her to stop the hormones. And if she happened to be taking them for heavy menstrual bleeding, the initiation of anticoagulation plus the withdrawal of the hormones precipitates major bleeding events in a concerning number
Sure.
of our female patients. So I was really pleased to see that they acknowledge that in this guideline, and I hope that clinicians will pay attention to that and incorporate those considerations into their practice.
No, I love that you brought this out because it really speaks to, you know, evidence-based care, but care that is reflective of embracing everybody, their needs, you know, being personalized to that aspect, or really understanding that we're not undermining a risk and removing those disparities of care. So I really appreciate you bringing that out
Sure.
from that. What other key takeaways as a pharmacist do you think, you know, pharmacists need to be aware of? You know, to your point, I think there's a lot related to anticoagulation management. I don't know if you want to briefly just give some high level. I think it's no surprise that the direct acting agents are supplanting, you know, warfarin and doing that process where we're able. Maybe to your point, like what do you take away in some of these higher risk, you know, patients that the pharmacist may have a role for?
So you mean like if they're in categories E1 and E2, what is the role of the
Yeah,
pharmacist in those patients?
you know, because maybe that's not what people are thinking top of mind, but yes, maybe that
Yeah, no,
would
I
be.
absolutely think pharmacists have a role in that. I mean, if you have a PERT team, you should make sure that there's a pharmacist on that PERT team because they are absolutely essential. If you don't have a PERT team and you're the pharmacist, advocate for starting, you know, start those conversations with your leadership and key stakeholders. But I think we are integral in, you know, that being embedded upstream in those, you know, those. Once a diagnosis is made, that patient needs to be started on anticoagulation very quickly. And the pharmacist can play a role in, you know, reviewing the patient's chart, looking for outside records, to help inform what is the best anticoagulant to start that patient on. And that might, you know, we might need to obtain labs, we might need to like serum creatinine, et cetera. But we can also augment the PERT team by like helping the physicians if it hasn't already been done, we can order things like troponins and BNPs, et cetera. So I think pharmacists can be integral in those ways. I also think, you know, we can be integral by starting care transitions and discharge processes early on in the process. Like we can start, you know, triaging DOAC co-pays or figuring out what's going to be a good long-term therapy for this patient or figuring out long-term follow-up, et cetera. So I think there's a number of ways that pharmacists can be involved, whether the patient's high risk, intermediate risk, or low risk.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to your point, it's not even just the anticoagulation. I think you alluded to this as like, you know, doing, you know, if we have to do lytics for one, but also, you know, if you have to deal with picking things for hemodynamic support, you know, so
Yeah.
using, you know, vasoconstrictors, or whatever that may be, or things to support ventricular function, however that may be from that standpoint. So I think that there's definitely a lot of opportunity and option from that standpoint for the pharmacists to be engaged from that.
Well, and I think you touched on an important point. I'll just take opportunity to expound on it.
Yeah.
And it gets to the heart of anti-thrombosis stewardship. You'll hear different terms out in the world, and we've kind of morphed away from anticoagulation stewardship over to anti-thrombosis stewardship, and that's intentional. And that's because we want clinicians to and we want care to evolve from just drug management to disease state management. And so, while we're focused largely on anticoagulants in these patients, you bring up lytics. Yes, some of these patients may need lytics. Which lytic are you going to have on formula? Are you going to have tenecteplase? Are you going to have alteplase? What dose are you going to use? The guidelines are now supporting consideration for lower dose or what's called safe dose lytics. So that may be something that you need to consider building into your protocols. But also other actions like, reviewing the patient for modifiable bleeding risk factors. Is the patient on concomitant antiplatelets? Now that they're going to be on anticoagulation, do we need to peel those back? And then, in extreme cases, sometimes even devices, right? Antithrombosis stewardship covers devices as well. So things like an IVC filter, et cetera. So lots of areas where pharmacists can weigh in and help make decisions and help drive better patient care.
Very good. And so I love this whole topic. So, and we kind of talked about this. Is there any other major anticoagulation recommendations that pharmacists, I know we talked just recently about lytics, but any things in your mind that pharmacists really need to be aware of from the anticoagulation perspective, or to that point in terms of the guidelines or anything that we've not touched upon?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. I think there are a couple of things that I want to point out to people. So you've already mentioned that, DOACs should be preferred as the oral anticoagulant over warfarin whenever possible, unless the patient can't, immediately take orals, and then you just want to make sure to get them onto a DOAC as soon as possible. What I want to discuss really quickly is the issue of low molecular weight heparin versus unfractionated heparin. Now, for low risk or VTEs that don't require advanced intervention, guidelines have for a number of years now advocated preferential use of low molecular weight heparin over unfractionated heparin, and that's because there's several studies and you need a large Cochrane meta-analysis that shows that when you use low molecular weight heparin for initial treatment of DVT or PE, it leads to significant reductions in recurrent VTE, no real impact on mortality, but a signal towards maybe a little bit less bleeding. So in those populations, low molecular weight heparin has long been preferred. Now, that's not always applied in practice, right?
Right.
I think there's a fair number of clinicians listening to this session that are saying, not in my ED, man. Everybody with a new blood clot gets put on a heparin drip. And I don't know about you, Craig, but I'm not a huge fan of heparin infusions because they are problematic and they
Oh,
are
problematic. No, I agree
medic.
with you. And that dogma of like, oh, but it's reversible and doing all the things, but in most patients, low molecular weight heparin is safe and effective, and we can do the things we need to do to manage them appropriately. Go ahead, sorry.
No, that's fine. I mean, I love your exuberance and I love your that you don't like heparin as much as I don't like heparin.
Well, it's funny. At one point, I heard of a hospital that banned heparin. Like, not obviously, you can't completely ban it
Oh
outright
yeah.
everywhere, but they really went to the effort to say we're not using heparin
Yeah, that was up
in
in
most of,
Canada and
yeah.
they virtually eliminated the use of unfractionated heparin and they saw, things like the rates of HIT and bleeding plummet. And so we've tried to take a similar tack at our institution. And that actually kind of, my deep dive in the literature and developing our protocols really lent itself to my being able to contribute to this discussion, I think, in the guidelines. But low molecular weight heparin is preferred in low risk, and so we should be doing that. We're often not doing that, but that's some low-hanging fruit that pharmacists and other clinicians should be looking to implement in their institutions. And I think now that we have these guidelines that clearly support that, I think that will bolster those efforts. Now, what's interesting is there is also a recommendation in the guidelines that for patients who are anticipated to undergo an advanced procedure, such as thrombolysis, catheter-directed thrombolysis, or catheter-based thrombectomy, so endovascular therapies, low molecular weight heparin can be considered as an alternative to unfractionated heparin. And where does this come from? Well, there's not a large evidence base for it. And unfortunately, there's only one small study that actually looked at this and randomized patients to unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin and then looked at bleeding rates. But the groups weren't, in fact, if I recall correctly, it wasn't randomized. It was just observational, and the groups were
Right.
imbalanced, but there was no difference in the bleeding rates. Where we got more of our information from was looking back at early studies like Topcoat and Moffitt, et cetera, that involved catheter-directed lysis. And what we found was that those studies often, in their protocols, preferred initial low molecular weight heparin. So the patient was anticoagulated with low molecular weight heparin throughout the entire procedure. And so building off of that, we looked to some of the more contemporary trials, and what we're starting to see in studies like PE TRACT, which is an ongoing randomized controlled trial,
Right.
and STORM PE. I mean, these trials are starting to talk about what anticoagulants and describing what anticoagulants are being used. And in a lot of cases, they're actually expressing preferential use of low molecular weight heparin. And I think there's a couple of reasons for this. I think one, it's been done in earlier trials and it seems to be safe, even if there may be a small increase in bleeding. But also because the practice right now, there's a lot of interest around thrombectomies, right? And when you're
Sure.
doing a thrombectomy, you're not introducing that bleeding risk of the lytic. And so
Correct. Right.
providers and procedurists seem to be more comfortable with doing this. And the other third arm of
Well, one
this,
thing,
Craig,
go ahead. So finish your, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
yeah, just
Sorry.
really quickly, the third arm of this that's driving it is that there's been some studies that have come out in the last handful of years. Now, they're not high quality prospective randomized trials, but what they're showing is that acute PE patients that are being heparinized for their PE are failing to achieve therapeutic levels of anticoagulation in a timely fashion. And we know from earlier studies from investigators like Russell Hull and Smith and others that if you want to prevent recurrence or progression of a PE or even death, you need to have your patient rapidly anticoagulated. And we're not always achieving that with heparin. And so that was a big driver behind this recommendation in the guidelines to consider low molecular weight heparin as an alternative, as long as your patient doesn't have other contraindications, right? Like they're not on dialysis, et cetera, or they're not, a high risk PE that's going to need cannulation for ECMO, where heparin is the first line anticoagulant therapy. So I think clinicians have an opportunity here to take these guidelines forward for multidisciplinary discussion and develop some protocols where low molecular weight heparin is used preferentially in the majority of
Sure.
acute VTEs.
No, I love this. And the other thing I was going to say, one of the things that you were talking about thrombectomy and the devices, one thing that has been nice is because you're not using lytics, you can also, maybe not send them to the unit and maybe get them out the door faster if they need to be, assuming that they're not in cardiogenic shock or anything to that. So I think it's worth pharmacists being aware of these things as well. Even though they're in theory feel like a proceduralist-based activity, and they are, but the pharmacist still needs to understand the impact of the therapy and the downstream with this. And eventually, anticoagulation will be in there. And then even the people are kind of moving away from catheter-based thrombolysis to in using some of these other thrombectomy-based devices. Anything else from anticoagulation from your perspective, Allison?
Oh, probably. I probably could talk about it for days,
Yeah.
but we can
No, I
move
mean, it's dense, right? It's a dense piece and an important part of this.
Exactly.
And I encourage people to look at it, but I think you've given a lot of major highlights, and we could probably have days and days of episodes on this. So, kind of, Allison, in a few weeks, ACC is going on, and we have this high PTO trial that's going to be present. And obviously, we already have these guidelines, but and I don't know if you want to briefly talk about this study, but how did you guys try to think about this trial coming out and what it could be, or did you not think about it, or kind of what or did you not even think about it at all? So.
No, I think there's lots of thoughts about it, and I don't know how we are for time, and I don't know if it's beneficial for listeners for me to just do a kind of a really high level recap of how we got to high pytho. So if you guys recall, the original pytho 1 was a study in acute PE patients looking at full dose systemic tenecteplase at doses up to 50 milligrams plus heparin versus heparin alone. And what that study showed was, it reduced cardiovascular collapse. It had no impact on mortality, but unfortunately, it also had a high rate of major bleeding around 11%. And I think intracranial hemorrhage was something like 2%. And so, landmark study. It led to subsequent studies with catheter-directed thrombolysis to see if that's maybe a safer approach. So we had trials like Ultima and Seattle 2 and Optilize. And so these studies used catheter-directed lysis with lower doses of lytics. And it appeared to be, safe and effective. But I think the shortcoming of these trials was they were all based on surrogate outcomes. And correct me if I'm wrong, Craig, but they were looking at things like RV/LV ratio at 24 hours post-lytic, or
Not necessarily hard outcomes per se, right?
right, exactly. So that informed the high pytho trial that Craig mentioned is going to be presented later in March at ACC. But what this is investigating is ultrasound assisted thrombolysis, catheter-directed thrombolysis, using the ECOS system, which has been around for more than a decade, I think. But they're looking at low-dose alteplase plus anticoagulation versus anticoagulation. And they're doing it, this is the interesting part, in an enriched population of patients that are considered to be to have intermediate high risk for PE and at risk for deterioration. So in my mind, Craig, and I want to hear your thoughts on this too, but this kind of approximates those category D patients on the new ACC AHA stratification schema. And I think, and the other interesting thing about the high pytho is that they are going to be looking at those hard clinical outcomes, including PE related mortality, the cardiorespiratory collapse, and recurrent fatal or non-fatal PE. So in my mind, it seems like if this trial is positive, it might have an impact on how we routinely manage PE patients that fall into this category. Maybe we're going to be offering more of them advanced therapy. But I don't know. What are your thoughts?
No, I exactly. I think that's the question that I look at this, and to the point we're actually going to have good solid data with outcomes, but then it'll really understand. Yeah, granted, some people are moving away from catheter-directed therapy, but it'll understand, is there a stronger role for this, or is it really a value, or could, in the flip, could anticoagulation alone be enough? And especially since we have more consistent anticoagulation, like we've been talking about, in that process, in those intermediate high risk. But I think clearly you have to, it is an enriched high risk population. So I'm excited to see. I think it goes back and gives us food for fodder for what you're saying. Like, this is an area that there's lots of things going on, and PE is not stagnant in terms of how we're managing it. And I suspect we'll have to be updating these guidelines sooner rather than later, and not going as long with what we had, and seeing how that works. So
Yeah,
that's my feeling,
great
but.
comments. And your comments made me think of something that's also, that they're doing that's different in the high pytho trials. They're using something called the NEWS score, which is the National Early Warning Score. And, unlike using a simplified PESI or something like that, that's like, you do a one-time measurement to risk stratify and that's it. They're implementing this NEWS score, which is also suggested for use in the guidelines. But it's basically continual reassessment of readily available vital signs to capture those patients who are deteriorating earlier so you can intervene earlier. So I think there's lots of cool things going on with the HI-PEITHO, and I anticipate, are you going to be at ACC and be in the
I
room when it's
will.
presented? Okay, well, we
I
want a
will
full
be.
report.
All right. We will. We are going to do it on this podcast, I promise.
Awesome.
Okay. So I know we've talked a little bit about PERT teams, so I don't want to expand too much into that or, just, for people to be engaged. And I think that's a great way for pharmacists to be aware of. And actually, there's a whole organization, that deals with PERT, and they do an entire conference around PERT, don't they,
They
Allison?
sure
So,
do. It's a great
yeah.
conference.
Yeah, and so if you're curious, you can most certainly learn more about PERTs if you're not doing them, and I think if you aren't doing them, there's ways to get them at any hospital or process. It's just having someone to lead and take the charge on this, and so a pharmacist could easily be that person, right, to set up that infrastructure if it's not there, and try to get the people going from that
Absolutely.
standpoint. So, Allison, we've kind of talked about this in the comment that I just mentioned. We clearly have identified that pharmacists have a role in PE management. We're encouraging pharmacists to understand and be engaged in PE. Kind of that next phase is, how do you suggest, and we kind of brushed this, how do you suggest pharmacists or people that are hearing this begin implementing these guidelines? Like, what would you encourage them to start with, or how would they start putting this in practice?
Yeah, well, as we've discussed, I mean, I think there's a number of ways for one, for pharmacists to just get more involved, right? Get more involved clinically, try to participate in, PERT discussions or be on rounds helping risk stratify patients, interpreting imaging and biomarkers. I think all those are good clinical ways to get involved. I also think pharmacists can be very important in building needed infrastructure, like we were just talking about building more refined protocols based on these guidelines, such as preferential use of low molecular weight heparin. But also, building internal things like getting notified about acute PEs in real time and having everybody on the thread so everybody can engage at once. So I think building those system level processes, and along with all that, that's, I mean, stewardship is really two major components. It's the clinical component and it's the continuous quality component. So I think a third way that pharmacists can support all of this is to measure efforts and use those to refine your efforts and then improve your performance. So continuous quality improvement. If I was a clinician, it's kind of starting at ground zero and I got these guidelines, I think a way I would go about it is I would sort of use it as a roadmap or a checklist, and I would, I guess, take a landscape survey, and I would say, okay, at our institution, what are we doing? What are we doing well? And then what are we not doing well, or what are we not doing at all? And then finding those gaps, and then working in a multidisciplinary fashion to fill those in, to come into alignment with these PE guidelines. I think it's going to be really important for there to be efforts, and they can be pharmacist led, et cetera. But there's going to need to be alignment with everybody that's involved around common risk stratification language. So it's probably going to be a little bit of a lift to shift away from ESC risk stratification to this new A to E stratification. But
Sure.
it's going to be really important that everybody is on the same page and everybody's speaking the same language and is wanting to intervene on the same types of patients for the most part. And then I guess my last thought, and I think this is a really important point, is that remember, fewer than 5% of patients are going to need advanced therapies based on
Right.
existing evidence. I would really encourage everyone to just go back and fortify their foundational standardized processes around anticoagulants, because while not many patients are going to need interventions. They're all going to need anticoagulation.
Yeah, no, it's back to antithrombotic stewardship, right?
Exactly,
Like,
exactly. And so
yeah.
go back and review those anticoag protocols and those care transitions processes, because getting your basics right is going to give you the most juice for your squeeze, for sure.
Well, and I love what you're saying. I think foundationally, the scoring system's a great starting point and really building off that. But then to your point, doing all this work around antithrombotic stewardship and putting that in place. So, Allison, I want people to think, and this is the way I try to think about this, is obviously people are thinking acute PE at the hospital and only thinking that all this only impacts hospital pharmacists. But do you think it's important for community pharmacists or others to be aware of these guidelines to your maybe to your point around care transitions and things like that?
Oh, for sure. For sure. This just, everybody should be aware that and I think most clinicians are, is that most VTE patients are being managed with a direct oral anticoagulant these days. And direct oral anticoagulants are awesome. They have been a game changer. But despite all their advantages, one of the big limitations with DOACs is that it leads to fewer touch points with our patients. We're not seeing them in the clinic for an INR check every few weeks or every month like we do warfarin patients. And sometimes we're only seeing these patients every 6 to 12 months, and a lot can happen between visits. And so this is where pharmacists that work in the community pharmacies, or if they're in ambulatory care clinics or specialized anticoagulation clinics, are absolutely essential to optimize management of PE patients. And so they need to be familiar with these guidelines, because they're often the pharmacists that are so critical, because they're identifying adherence issues, drug-drug interactions, side effects like bleeding, or perhaps if the patient runs into something like loss of access to their medications or cost barriers. And so, yes, pharmacists all along the care continuum absolutely should be familiar with these guidelines, so they can best support their patients with PE and DVT.
Perfect. I love it. Allison, thank you for your time. One thing we do, we try to get people to realize that we're all humans and that we're not just doing pharmacy work or anything. Is there anything you've currently been reading, listening to, or watching that you would recommend?
Reading, listening, or watching.
Is a
I got a
book, a
couple.
podcast? Yeah, go ahead.
It's not a podcast. I will say, for listening, I actually would give a shout out to something called Wake Me Up Meditations on YouTube. They are free,
Okay.
they are guided. It's an excellent way to start your day, so check it out.
Yeah.
As far as reading, I'm going on a sea kayaking camping trip in Baja, Mexico, in a couple weeks, Craig. And so I bought a book by John Steinbeck called A Log Book from the Sea of Cortez, to get a little bit of historical fiction there. And
Yeah.
then last thing is, what am I watching? I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So anybody who is familiar with Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul knows that those shows were filmed here. There's a new show by the same director, Vince Gilligan, called Pluribus. And it's a sci-fi series, and it's really cool. So I would encourage you to
I've
see
seen that. Okay, yeah, very good.
it.
Allison, if people wanted to find you, do you have are you LinkedIn, social media? Maybe they don't want to find what would if people wanted to ask you additional questions or
Oh,
anything
for
like that?
sure. Yeah, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to respond to any questions that anyone might have.
Perfect. Allison, thank you so much for your time. This has been great. I appreciate your insights always. It's always good to talk to you and work with you on things. So
Likewise, Craig. Always a pleasure.
perfect. Anyways, everyone, I hope you liked this episode. If you want to hear more about this, like and subscribe. We'll put the guidelines in the show notes and that way you can peruse them yourself. Again, please like, subscribe, share with your friends, give us a review, reach out to us so we can continue to make this content better. And we're soon going to be moving into our ACC 26 content. So excited for this whole process to come underway. So, Allison, thank you, and everyone else, have a good day.